It's now Monday, September 6, 2010, and we're in Elizabeth Ratcliffe's library and to listen to something about her story.
Okay, Dave is visiting, and he's visiting from Massachusetts all the way to California to help my husband and me begin to once more move into a new phase of our lives. This will be in November the 3rd of 2010. Lewis and I will have been married, I think it's 8 years, maybe 9 years. It's the second marriage for both of us. And we are now in our middle 80s. I think I'm 86 and he's 87. And his birthday is 3 days before mine, so it's October 30th, and mine is November 1st. Is that 3 days before? Anyway, I've had a long and rich life, and Dave is here wanting to record some of that. I think it's appropriate that he has focused on the books behind me, because they have been books and using my creative process and new learnings have been key focuses for a very long life and a happy life. I will start with being born, and I was born in Vermont, in Barre, Vermont, which was my father's home, and November 1st, 1923. We were on furlough. My family were missionaries in China. I have two brothers, had two brothers. Oldest one is Harold, and he was 6 years older. Next one is James, called Jim, or Jama, and he is still alive. James is still alive. He's 3 years older than I am, so I guess he's 89 or 90. And they were both brothers were born in China. They were able to be American citizens because their births were recorded in the Beijing, North China American consulate. So they could, although born in foreign country, be president, could have been president. That's what the Constitution or some governmental document says. We always used to laugh about that. I've had a very long journey from there. Probably was conceived in China, but born in my father's hometown, Barre, Vermont, very small village. When my family came back from China in 1923, so I was born in this country, and I went back to China with my family when I was, I think, a year and a half old. I don't remember it, of course. But the furlough was over, and it was time to go back to China. And the time in China for my family was every 7 years, and then there'd be a furlough. So I was there in China. We came back for a furlough when I was 8 or 9, in the 30s, middle 30s. And then again in 1940, my brothers had already come back to go to college, and it was just my mother and father and me that came back in 1940. I had 1 year of high school left in Newton High. I think there were something like 2,000 students there at that time. It was in Massachusetts. And I had come from a very small boarding school outside of Beijing in Tungzhou, where I think there were about 40 students at that time. So it was going from it was a very large frog in a very small pond to a teeny-weeny tadpole in a huge American high school. It was an interesting year, and I was very lost until I graduated. And then going to college as a freshman at Wellesley, it was pretty easy to decide about Wellesley, because a friend had gone there and I was able to get scholarship there. It was a very good place for me. It's not true of all my friends, but I enjoyed it, and I was able to nourish my mind with many, many interesting classes and wonderful teachers. And it gave me an insight into different kinds of subjects. I thought I would major in literature or English writing because I love to read and to write, and my mother had a good background in English, and she was my teacher for many years as a, at homeschooling, and then when we went, I went to boarding school as a sixth grader. My parents also were there at this boarding school because the Depression was going on at that time. It was in the 30s, early 30s, and my mother and father were moved out of a mission field in Shandong province to be principal and teacher at this boarding American boarding school outside of Beijing. So my mother taught me English there, and I was a member of the sixth grade class. There were just three of us there, three in the class. So I was surprised at Wellesley to discover a field called art history. And although I thought that I would be an English major and be a writer, or write, learn how to write, because I had loved to read and I enjoyed writing, I discovered I would have to write a novel to graduate from Wellesley if I were in, if I was an English major, and I knew I could not do that. That was impossible. That was too much of a task, and already I had discovered art history. The first year in college, I had one full year of something called Byzantine Medieval Art History. I didn't know what it was, but it was a class taught about early art, Western art, and largely laid in Istanbul or Constantinople. And the whole Byzantine history of that era, 9th through 14th century, I believe. And it was just fascinating to me. So it was pretty easy to change from being a lit major, an English major, to being an art history major. And I have loved art ever since and been fascinated by the way of learning about the history of mankind and prehistory through the art. I think the whole creative process of human beings is one of the things that's always been very moving to me and very important. And I want to just look at this just for a minute, this title, Gifts Differing. It's a it's about a process that Carl Jung discovered and created, actually, to learn how human beings function and personality types. And Jung was always fascinated by the differences in human beings and how introverts and extroverts function differently. I'm an introvert, and there are far fewer introverts in this country, in the United States, than in other parts of the world. Our basis here in the United States is appreciation of and seeming to have about 75% of extroverts rather than introverts. And Jung valued everybody. The introvert was just as important as the extrovert, although the introvert is more interior. And I think that a lot of my life has been, because I'm an introvert, and an inner life that has allowed me to be out in the world, and as I've gone through life, to experiment more because of my curiosity and my interest, and because of my interest in art, and having been raised really in China. This is a very important aspect of who I am. I believe that people who aren't raised in the United States have had an opportunity to learn about different cultures. And I have been labeled by other people in the course of my long life, meeting as once a year in reunions from those who were educated in Beijing and American people, as missionaries or business people, or even in the military. We have attended either Tungzhou American School or Peking American School. And we've had reunions since 1983, maybe a couple times or once every 2 years or so across the country. And a lot of us have died off, so those reunions have become more sparse. But in learning about these other folks like myself, at first when we came back to the United States, we didn't want to acknowledge we had lived and were different. We just wanted to fit in and be Americans. And when we were around in our middle 40s, I think, it seems to have been a trend that by that time we began to reevaluate our lives and appreciate the differences that we had lived under and the different kinds of outlook on the world and on lives, our own lives and other people's lives. There's just a less egocentric, seems to me, kind of attitude that you're just subjected to by knowing a different culture or other cultures. So the Western culture is just one part of our lives. And I think that in my experience of other people who have lived in other countries as kids, brought up in other countries, who maybe just adopted other countries as adults, there our outlooks are quite different. After college, I was married very quickly. This was in the time of the Second World War, and the thing to do was to get married. And I found a man who seemed most eligible and was well-educated also at Harvard and Harvard Medical School, married John Ratcliffe, shortly after graduating. Before that, after graduation, I worked for a short time at the Fogg Museum in Cambridge for the last living grandson of Ralph Waldo Emerson as a kind of a secretary and a Girl Friday. That time was cut short because I thought I wanted to be a nurse. And I moved from Cambridge to New York City to go to nursing school. I lasted all of 6 weeks there. I discovered I didn't like sick people. I couldn't make them well, and that was too much for me. Eventually, I did become a therapist, a psychotherapist. And, of course, you don't make people well in psychotherapy. You just help them through difficult times and get them to hold on until they do get well or better. So I quit this idea of becoming a nurse, and came back to Cambridge, worked for a little while again for Ralph Waldo Emerson's grandson, Mr. Forbes, and then re-encountered John Ratcliffe, or he re-encountered me. We got married shortly, and he was in the Navy. We lived in Norfolk, Virginia for, I believe, about a year while he was doing his time in the Navy. Then we moved from Norfolk to Framingham, Massachusetts, where our first child, Steve, was born. Stephen Robinson Ratcliffe was born in 1948. We lived there several years. I'll try to rush through this. At that time in Framingham, two more children were born. Bruce Alan Ratcliffe was born in 1950, and Patricia Ann Ratcliffe was born in 1952. During those years, we lived on very little money, but you could buy a loaf of bread, seems to me, for something like 10 cents, and all of our friends were very, very living on short rations. Actually, it was a wonderful life. We didn't have much money. But they were all doing internships or residencies in the medical profession in Framingham, where there's a VA hospital, and John was doing his surgical residency. when the residency was finished and John had his medical credentials as a surgeon, we began looking for places to move and to set up in practice. And we wrote many, many, many letters all over the country, thinking the only way to move out of being a student, which he had been for all these many years, was to have another school or another agency to be taken care of by, instead of plunging out and having your own. We wrote every clinic in the country, I'm sure, and they all said they had plenty of surgeons, general surgeons. And this is at the end of the Second World War, so the veterans were coming back, and they were filling all these positions. We finally gave up on actually having to have a place that would accept us, to setting out, and John would have his own office and his own business. And my oldest brother, Harold, had come to California. He also was a doctor. In fact, my two brothers both had been gone to medical school, first of all at Dartmouth, and then had gone to Harvard to finish their training. James was still doing time in the Navy, and John, by this time, my husband, had graduated from his internship and time at Framingham Veterans Hospital and getting his training as a surgeon, his individualized training. But Harold found that California was wide open. And he said, why don't you just come out to California and look around? So John went out and looked around and found San Mateo in Northern California, which was just south of, it's a suburb more or less of San Francisco. And he met some interesting people there and decided that he would come. He came back and we talked it over. Then he flew out and began setting up his office and looking for a place for his family to live. Patty had been born, was born in 1952 when was Patty born? May. And she was only a few months, or maybe 2 or 3 months old. And I flew out, having packed up the apartment that we lived in Framingham, and with a nursing baby and two little boys. Patty was just born, probably 2 or 3 months old. Bruce was 2, and Steve was 4. And here, this little tribe of a quartet began to cross the country. And John didn't want us to go by plane. He was afraid the plane might come down and we'd lose his whole family. So we had made train reservations. Well, as it turned out, we missed the train in New York. It just pulled out. We were in a traffic jam to get to the station. And Jim and Hope, his wife, they lived in Summit, New Jersey, I think, at that time. And they had brought us from Framingham. And we stayed with them a few days. Then they were going to drive us to the station, Grand Central or Penn, I'm not sure which, in New York City, where we had reservations. Well, we missed the train because of a traffic jam, traffic tie-up, and there was nothing to do but to fly, because here we were, mother, young mother, tiny baby, two little boys, all kind of scruffy and getting a little antsy. So we just made reservations and got on the plane overnight, flew overnight, came down in Chicago, and I believe Bruce still remembers falling off the seat on the floor at some point. He was 2. And Steve had to sort of take charge of, he was the man of the family. I carried the baby, and Steve sort of bandaged Bruce, and it was quite a flight. And I didn't want John to know that right away so he wouldn't worry about it. So Jim, my brother Jim, called John in San Mateo to tell him that his little group of 4 people was going to be flying in, and he should come and meet us at the airport. And John didn't have any time to worry. So he was there when we landed, and we found a place to live in, San Mateo, garden apartments down in Hillsdale, southern part of San Mateo, where we stayed. We lived 2 or 3 years while he set up his practice and began making friends with him in the medical community, and bought our first car. Oh, I think John's parents gave us that car, and it was a station wagon. I'm not sure they gave it to us. We bought it. We had a station wagon, a very old one, because the cars were not being made at that time. We got a second-hand one. Eventually, it was replaced by their John's parents giving us their old Dodge, or old gray Dodge. And we moved from the Hillsdale Garden Apartments, to San Mateo Park. Edgewood Road. I think it was 336 Edgewood Road.
426.
426. I'm being helped by my cameraman here, Dave. And Dave was not yet born. When we moved to 426 Edgewood Road, it was just with three children. And I'm not sure exactly what year that was, but shortly thereafter, after we had gotten settled into 426 Edgewood Road, I'm looking at the time to cut this short, very short, very shortly, because we need to eat lunch. And 426 Edgewood Road, David Thompson Ratcliffe was born in Mills Hospital in 1955. And I remember I was out for all four of my children. In those days, they would give you a subdural so that you wouldn't be aware of your children being born. And I remember I went to the hospital and spent the night there thinking that Dave would come down the birth canal. And I had brought with me a huge fat book that was called Cloister on the Hearth. It was a book out of about the medieval times. And I was reading that book all night as I was going through labor. Finally, as the labor got closer and Dave was about to come, I was put out. I was given a subdural medication so I wouldn't have the pain of childbirth. I've never felt the pain of childbirth. I've just seen little babies after they're born. And I know young women today want to go through the pain of birth. I never had that experience. So at this point, David Thompson Ratcliffe joined us at 426 Edgewood Road, so there were six of us there. I think we had Rover, a black dog at that time, and shortly thereafter we had a wonderful woman coming to live with us. Her name was Elizabeth von Ruffini, and she was from Germany and had emigrated to the United States. Her brothers had all been Nazi fighters. I think they were all airplane mechanics. No, not mechanics. They were Nazi pilots. And I remember she had a picture of one. Elizabeth had a picture of one of her brothers in a coffin, which I think had been shot down. I think they were all killed in the war. But she was a wonderful woman, and she really helped out tremendously. David Thompson Ratcliffe, number four child, didn't have my full attention, but Elizabeth was there. And he had a lot of skin problems, as I remember. We kept going to try to get ways to cure his skin problems. Had a lot of earaches, too. And but good old Liz von Ruffini. What did we call her?
Lizard.
Lizard von Ruffini was there, and she helped us through a lot of many difficult times with the whole family. She became a family member. And I think it's now 10 after 12, and it's time to make lunch.
So we'll pause.
Okay, we have taken a little break. We're coming back, and I will skip most of the middle years in my family and my kids growing up. I was divorced. John and I divorced in 19... I'm never quite sure what year, but it was 66. In the 50s sometime.
66,
I'm being encouraged to say. And they were, like a lot of married couples, we've been married 20 years, and it was the era of divorces becoming very common, and it was a mutually arranged, decided upon choice. It was very rough. But the second half of my life, when I married Lewis, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, whatever it was, and he knew something of my history, he said to me, "I'm so sorry you had to go through such hard times." And I, looking back, I don't believe they were. I think I was very fortunate. It was a time of growing up for me and finding out really who I was. And I told him that I wasn't at all sorry, and that hardships, everybody had hardships along the way. And my hardships turned out to be great blessing, because they were my learning about life and about what it was to be a whole person and find ways to use my different gifts. This book is called Gifts Differing. It's a book about Carl Jung's Myers-Briggs Personality Inventory. I think it was late in my, around the time I was divorcing in the early 60s, that I went and got a teaching credential. It was before I was divorced, actually. And I decided I would like to teach art history in the San Mateo schools. And I was innocent enough to think that I would be hired by the San Mateo schools to teach art history, which was my college major, and I loved it. So I was hired on by the school district to do a team teaching stint with a social studies and an English teacher. And they were both excellent, and I was the third person on that team. I did get a credential, a high school credential, and I was allowed to make my own slides. And so I was able to teach a full year, and I think a part of the next, but I'm not sure. Anyway, at that very moment in the history of the schools, the teachers were being let go. So I was the first hired and the first fired. No, not fired, let go. And I realized that I loved that teaching, and I loved the art history part, and I loved getting to learn a little bit about how to create slides and so forth. So I decided I would get a master's degree and get a better job in an upper division teaching situation. I didn't know how I'd do this, but I took a cruise, and I went through the Mediterranean. It was a 6 weeks cruise on a British ship called, it was Swan's Cruises at that time. It was a wonderful, very intense, very intellectual group of people traveling to learn about ancient history and ancient art, and it was all through the Mediterranean. And I took the cheapest way of going. I was in the bowels of the ship. There were, it was a women's dormitory, and we had bunks, and we all had a lower bunk, and the upper two bunks were for our clothes. And we went through Greece and Turkey, and it was all on this wonderful old, it was a World War II Turkish troop ship that had been turned into a cruise ship. Every night we would have lectures about what we'd see the next day. And we went to many Greek islands, and then we went through the Bosphorus to Istanbul. And in Istanbul, I went to the Kerye Cami, and I have some volumes up here. Kerye Cami is a monastery built by the Byzantine emperor in 1200 and something, 13th century. And in the Karyajami, when we went there on tour, I saw these murals up in the on the walls, and they were also 15th century, 13th century, no, could have been 14th century, and they looked very much like Giotto, and they weren't like the Byzantine art I'd studied in high school, in college at all. That 1 year of Byzantine art was flat and very decorative, and here these were rounded figures and very statuesque and full of emotion, and they looked like Giotto, and I was wondering how in the world could these two things be true, that my college years taught me about early Byzantine art, and then here, 20 years later, 20 more than that, I was seeing Byzantine art of the imperial era in Istanbul, and I wondered about how that could be Giotto-like art, full-bodied, rounded, emotional figures, not the flat, very decorative sort of inspiring kinds of being scared figures of the Byzantine art I had learned about before. So when I came home and I had this experience being let go teaching, I decided I'd get this master's degree. And I went up to University of Oregon, and I was accepted in the program there to do a master's degree in Byzantine medieval art history. So I had moved. I moved up to Oregon, bought a little house in Talent, Oregon, and moved. That was maybe 200 miles from Eugene. And I found out that the University of Oregon did give degrees, master's degrees and PhDs in both Byzantine ancient art and Byzantine medieval art history. So I went up, and I was at first turned down because the head of the department thought I was too old. I was by then 43 or 4. And then he needed more people in that department because, after all, who would want to go take art history in Byzantine and medieval specializations? But they did have the teacher, so he accepted me. And so I was one of the few people getting a degree in Byzantine medieval art history. And the reason why I went there, I was so thrilled because I could find out why it was that in Istanbul, in the 1200s and something, or 1300s, these figures appeared in this marvelous monastery, Karyajami, which was the imperial monastery, most beautiful in the world. Why they had these figures that were like Giotto, which weren't Byzantine, early Byzantine. It was like a cross in Florence, that type of Byzantine figures. So I studied that, and I had a lot of fun. And never went there, wish I had, but I selected as my focus point a little tiny chapel called Studenica. And it was, I cannot think of the name of the place, but it was closed, but in the country. It was a monastery, and it was the monastery of the kings at that time in Serbia. Serbia was geographically well located. It also had lots of sheep, so they had both skins and leather to market, and they also discovered tin in Serbia. So it became a crossroads for trade from the imperial Istanbul across to Western Europe. And these little monarchs, they were very primitive kings and princes, and they wanted to establish a dynasty in I can't think of the name of the place, but Studenica was their royal monastery. And nobody that I knew of, and I doubt that it's happened since, had ever written about this tiny, tiny chapel. And inside the chapel, I found books on the chapel, and my advisor named George Stricovic, who was from Serbia, knew about it. He was an archaeologist and an art historian and could read Greek, which was very helpful because I couldn't, and a lot of the information was in Greek. I did pass a German reading exam, however, although I failed it 5 times and finally passed it. And I was glad I had passed it because there was a lot of reading in German, research reading, and I was able to really learn a lot that way. So I, with Mr. Stritchevich, I was able to write a thesis, and it was very interesting. I found out that the Byzantine emperor had employed the best artists from Florence. He had enough money and enough power to bring them in that same Giotto, a little bit later century, over to Istanbul to do his royal art and do this wonderful, wonderful, powerful Karyajami monastery, which still stands. It is incredible. It also is, it's doesn't have the traditional tessera of mosaics. It's painted. The paintings are on the wall so that they are frescoes. And that's why these figures are like the Florentine figures that I had learned about in my art history years at Wellesley. They were not. They were like the early Renaissance figures. And that's when these artists had... They were trained by Giotto and Giotto, his followers, and the emperor was able to bring them over. Okay, so I'll move from that. It was very exciting. I finished that and even went with Mr. Stritchevich down to Los Angeles and gave my paper in a graduate program down there, which was the most amazing. Who in the world studies Byzantine medieval art history? Anyway, I did give a little talk about my paper, and... I could then, after graduating, I couldn't find a job. Nobody wanted to hire a Byzantine medieval art historian. I could have gotten a job at the small island in Alaska, where they had, I'm sorry, I can't think of the name, but it's very small, and it's a it has an Orthodox church there, Greek or Russian Orthodox church, and a collection of icons. Of 18th century Roman icons, and they had never been cataloged, and they were looking for somebody to come and catalog those icons. They would have hired me. However, they had no place for a woman to stay on the island, and also they wouldn't pay me anything. Two of those things kept me away from the job. So I didn't know what to do, so I came back to the Bay Area, and I had a friend who had gone through Cal State Hayward counseling department and had loved it, and she said, you know, you should come and get this degree. It's so perfect. It's a wonderful thing, and I've always been interested in people, and I've been interested in this whole idea of people with different gifts. And I decided I would come to Hayward, and I did enrolled at Cal State Hayward. They didn't have any trouble accepting me. They were eager for students. And I have an interesting background because of this experience in the University of Oregon. So what I did there, I took my idea of the power of art and how the Byzantine emperor had used it to keep hold of his people. The ancient early Byzantine emperors, with their very flat surfaces and their huge dome ceilings, and the people would come in to worship, the Orthodox, all of the people, and they would feel this power, the imperial power coming down on them from this Christ figure up in the top. And the Byzantines used what is called reverse perspective in their cathedrals, so that instead of having the figure of Christ in the large dome, just as a faraway figure sort of floating, they had him very powerfully outlined, and his eyes were very dark, and the outline of his face, and his hair was black, and he looked very fierce. And so people would feel the power of the church, the imperial emperor, and the church itself. And so this is what that part of the Byzantine art was about. It was very spiritual, and it was very scary. Anyway, I decided to do a master's thesis on the power of art. And I did, in the course of that, I went to Esalen a couple times, and I took a workshop which involved the participants in the workshop working with postcards on the floor. I'm not sure they were postcards, but they were pictures cut out from magazines, all kinds of pictures of every sort, and you were to walk around on them, choose the ones that you felt somehow pulled you to them, whether you liked them or you didn't like them, and then sit and think about why it was, and then we would discuss in this group our particular selections. And I found this a very powerful medium for emotionally transforming my unconscious into something with that was out there through these pictures. So I did a thesis and I did a research project involving this kind of thing. I collected a lot of postcards and I got permission from the Hayward school district, high school district, and it was very hard because they didn't trust anybody working with their kids. But I got permission to do a project, pre and post test, using high school students. I think I used sophomores, juniors, and seniors. And we had two sessions, and the kids could volunteer to come. They weren't dragged in. And they went through this process with the postcards, and I worked out a whole process so that the kids would have a certain amount of time to pick out the postcards that they were drawn to, either because they were repelled by or they liked them. And then with a little stack, maybe this many postcards, to sit on the floor in groups of two or three or four, and put them down and make a collage, taking about 15 minutes to think about each picture where it belonged in their collage. And then the last part of the process was each kid had a chance to talk about their collage, and I call that the collage of yourself and you know, what it tells you. And as the process, as I studied and read a lot about this sort of psychological work, as you begin to, the image is very powerful, then you take it inward and it becomes unconscious, then you talk about it and it becomes very conscious. And the kids then, they did a pre-test about their self concept and post-test. And it was very interesting because there was wasn't huge, but there was enough statistical proof that these kids had learned something about themselves in this process. And it was a very good study. And I put this thesis together. And I still didn't have a job, of course. But I, at the same time, became acquainted with College of Notre Dame that was setting up an art therapy program. And I realized that what I had learned was something about the power of art, as therapy. So I joined this little group of women that were putting together the program, and by that time I had another master's degree, second one, in psychology. And they hired me on, and I had a job, finally. And it was very exciting. I taught there for 13 years as an adjunctive professor, and I traveled around the country at different psychological conferences, doing this old master's art collage. Now, that all ties into my... being very much intrigued with Carl Jung and Carl Jung's difference between Jung and Freud, the differences. Jung valued art, and he realized that this was one of the tools he used learning about himself, and his Red Book, which has recently been allowed to be published. I won't talk about that, but it's amazing. And he used that when he went into a several months psychotic break when he was in his 50s or 60s and did this Red Book, which was all artwork. This is the world of Carl Jung and image. This whole idea of the image as being so important to the inner person, to the unconscious, and how our dreams reflect in images and what they tell us. So I, with my master's in psychology, I was able to be in two fields at once. And I used the old master's art collage at the College of Notre Dame in Belmont for these 13 years. I also taught graduate students there. And this was a very good experience for me. At the same time, I was also teaching women in groups, and then at the Displaced Homemaker Center on Mills College, women who were going through divorce or had lost their husbands in some way or another, and had to take over in midlife and be the breadwinner. And these were called displaced homemakers. And these women, some of the, before the displaced homemakers, I met with very undereducated women in Hayward itself at the Women's Center, which had been founded there. It was so interesting to me. These women really thought they didn't have any rights, that they were the tools for their husbands' slaves, if you will. And I remember one woman being very astounded to learn that that the ad she read about saw pictures of women cleaning their houses when they had high heels on and their hair was beautifully done. They had all their makeup on and they were pushing their little brooms, and that she was supposed to be doing the same thing, all dressed up. And she only, she cleaned the house in her slippers and her house coat, and she felt that she was something wrong of her. I guess her husband criticized her. So I began women's work at that time, and the rest of my life, I've been very much interested in the role of women and helping women get to value themselves and to find their role in, with their differing gifts, become whole people. And this is one of the themes of my life, I think. And it's important because I myself was living that out. So I think maybe this is enough for now.
Okay.
There's a lot more, but this is kind of my academic part.
One last part. What do you remember? What the years were for the 13 years at College of Notre Dame? What
the years at Notre Dame? I'm being asked. Well, they probably were. I got my license to be a marriage and family counselor in 1978, and they were probably from 78, what would be 13 years? 78.
Or 91?
Probably 91 or 92. And I had a lot of work by that time. I had my private practice, and to go down to Belmont once a week was more than I needed, and I didn't make very much money, but it had given me a sense of being a professional person. And the women I taught in this master's degree program were between the ages, let's say, of just having graduated from college into their 60s. A lot of people came back to become counselors, and there was this art therapy program was brand new in the country. It was one of about five, I think, graduate schools for art therapy. So I presented I was a real find for them. And, of course, it was my own life again, and I had a lot of fun. So I think I was there until, 91, 92, something like that. And then I was making enough money in my own private practice here in Berkeley to not need that, and I missed it, but I didn't need it. So I had, my life was already full by then. So enough for now.
Wonderful.
Aren't you gonna do that?
And here we are on September 6, 2010. And Lewis would like to share. We just seen the other day the first part of the four-part series, Cadillac Desert, about water and nature and California. And Lewis, after we saw that, had this to share.
Yes, this story is a story about, I call it the high point of my career. And the high point that is referred to geographically is the White Mountain Peak in Mono County. And my career was, at the time, a personnel manager on the Berkeley campus of the University of California. The reason I got involved in this story is it comes about from two sources. First, my father's ranch, and then secondly, the job I held at UC. My father's ranch was in Mono County, about 25 miles north of Bishop. Bishop is the city and small town in Inyo County, and the county line lies between Bishop and the place where the ranch was. And my father owned this ranch from about 1912 to 1923 or so. And the ranch lies at the base of White Mountain Peak. Now, White Mountain Peak is the high point in the White Mountain Range, which lies east of the Sierras. And it's quite different from the Sierras geologically and climate-wise. The White Mountains are very dry, and their slopes are fairly gentle. And so it lends itself to a different kind of use than the Sierras. And the reason my father owned a ranch in that place was that the water from the west slope of White Mountain Peak drained right down through the ranch, and it was a source of water for irrigation on the ranch. And a lot of what I remember about it, I got from stories that my father told me and also my older brother, George. George was 13 years older than I, and he lived there for some years when he was a boy, so he had a lot of memories of the ranch. And how the ranch gets into this story that I'm about to tell goes like this. In 1958, when I was working as a personnel manager at UC Berkeley, I had occasion to become familiar with the work of a high-altitude research station, which UC operated on the high up in the White Mountains. And there were two laboratories where high-altitude research was conducted. One was at about 10,000 feet, and another one about 12,000 feet, both of them lying south of White Mountain Peak. And this laboratory came to my attention because the people there who were running it wanted me as personnel manager to sort of bless and confirm their unusual work schedules for the employees who were stationed there. They, instead of having a normal work week of 5 days on and 2 days off, the employees had a more prolonged cycle of work, like over a period of 4 weeks they might work, say, 20 days on and then have 8 days off. And this produced some complications in applying personnel rules to their benefits and their vacation credit and so on. And so I was asked to not to establish a work schedule for them, but to accept and so to speak, confirm the legality of the schedule they had for these employees who worked there during the both year round, both summer and winter. And so they invited me to come up and view the laboratories and talk to the employees if I wanted to and see the conditions that they worked under. And so I was invited to bring along a guest, and I brought my brother George as my guest. And we drove ourselves up to Big Pine, which is the first little town south of Bishop, where the laboratory had its sort of base of operations, where their equipment was stored, and where we checked out a Jeep as our vehicle, and we put our sleeping bags and whatnot in the back of the Jeep, and merrily went driving off the road toward the mountains. And to get there, you go east from Big Pine and up to the ridge of the mountains and then drive along a private road that was constructed for this purpose of driving along the back of the mountains to the north, gradually gaining an altitude to where these laboratories are located. On the way, we pass through the forest of trees, which are supposed to be the oldest trees in the country, maybe anywhere in the world, bristlecone pine trees, and which is a unique species that grows in the high altitudes of the mountains in the western United States. And we got out and looked at them and read the material about them, and we were duly impressed with how aged these trees looked, and then drove up to the first laboratory, which is, as I say, is about 10,000 feet. We spent our first night there. The next day, we drove along this dirt road visited the second laboratory, and then drove all the way up to the summit of White Mountain Peak, which is approximately 14,200 feet. And by the middle of the afternoon, we were there, and we were able to view the world for 360 degrees all around, and it was a magnificent place to be, to see the Sierras to the west, the whole range of the Sierras, all the way from down around Mount Whitney, all the way up to the minarets and so on in Yosemite Park. And but the most important point of all was to look straight down. And down there, 10,000 feet below us, was the little green square, which was the ranch where George had lived when he was a boy, and he could identify it and relate to that irrigated spot as being the place where he had lived when he was a youngster. And then we turned around, drove back down off the mountain, and turned in the vehicle, and that was the end of our junket to White Mountain Peak. And it's a unusual experience because very few people get the chance to go up there. And I've read about it from time to time, and remember it as a place that I had visited. And my brother had a camera, and he took some pictures of us and of the view to the west, to the Sierras. And the picture that he took of me, I referred to as the high point of my career. And that's the story.
What about also that the Navy or the Air Force, somebody had it before you see?
I'm not certain of the, but I think the Navy had built these facilities and gotten interested in high altitude research during World War II. And then after the war was over, the management of the scientific part of the work was taken over by university people, and there was a professor of physiology on the Berkeley campus who was the director of the scientific work. But the Navy still was supplying some of the supplies, and for all I know, they was paying the costs of maintaining these buildings. And I think the Jeep that we drove in was actually a U.S. government vehicle, so there was still a strong influence of financing from the Navy, even though the university was responsible for the scientific work, and various graduate students had projects which they performed there, and they came up and visited and went away and so on. But the university was the employer of these maintenance people who lived there and worked there, and it was because of their working conditions that I got involved. And I don't think what I did was anything significant, because I think they were doing it already. It was just a question of recognizing it and getting a formal arrangement approved for the way they their work schedules were set up.
Mm-hmm. One more thing you've shared before, even just to touch upon, at your father's ranch, before he sold it, what was the story about the material that was used in spark plugs?
Yes. Why was he, did he get involved in the mine? This is a story my father told me, and so I'm just passing it on. During World War I, when high-performance engines were being built for aircraft, it turned out that the spark plugs that were used in automobile engines would short out when they were used in airplane engines. So the manufacturer of the Champion spark plugs was a man who had been a dentist, and he had gotten involved in the study of porcelains because he wanted to find better porcelains originally for his dental work, but also for making spark plugs when he got involved in manufacturing. And he came out to this ranch originally in about, I think it was about the summer of 1917, let's say, and did some prospecting himself. He said that he had found references in geological reports to geologists having located a deposit of a mineral called andalusite, so-called because it was found and first identified in Andalusia, Spain. And he thought that this particular aluminum silicate would be useful as a base for making spark plug porcelains. And so he prospected up in the high mountains using the ranch as his base the first summer, and he couldn't find it. Then he hired my father the subsequent summer, and my father did find it. He backpacked himself up into the 10,000-foot level on the west side of White Mountain Peak, and located this outcropping of this mineral. And sure enough, it was what the dentist had been looking for, and subsequently, that company, the Champion Spark Plug Company, proceeded to invest in a mine for the purpose of extracting andalusite and bringing it down out of the mountains down to the base of the mountain, and and shipping it by rail back to Detroit. There was a whole narrow gauge railroad that ran right by the up and down that stretch of country from Benton down to Bishop, and it was possible to ship the mineral back to the east by rail, but it had to be carried out of from the mine down a trail by mules down to the base of the mountain, and then repacked and put on rail cars. And my father was the manager of this mining operation for the company, and that became eventually his full-time occupation. And then in about 1923 or so, after I was born, that's how I was told, that he the job of running this operation was taken away from my father and given to a relative of the company president, and my father lost his job as the mine manager, and they bought the ranch from him. So he invested in a house in Bishop, which was the town that they were familiar with, and the family lived in Bishop from about 1923 to 1926. And I was, of course, I was born in 1922, so I was an infant when the family moved to the house in Bishop. But I remember the trip after the house, after we left the house in Bishop and moved down to Riverside. I remember that trip. And my father eventually sold that house because it was located on a creek in near Bishop, where it had water rights. And as we learned in the film, Cadillac Desert, this city of Los Angeles was buying up all those properties in the 30s, trying to gain all the water rights they could collect and use the water for the water that was shipped down to Los Angeles, eventually through the aqueduct from approximately from Owens Lake to Los Angeles. So I have some slight memory of these events after the move, but most of what I've said is, comes from the stories my father told me and my brother told me.
Yeah, quite a time. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm glad to share it with you.
We'll do some more.